Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 15th, 2005. Today's session is entitled Global Warming: Do We Know Everything We Need to Know? Presented by Brent Lofgren. Disc number LOB-2005-03.
My name is Brent Lofgren. I'm from Ann Arbor, Michigan. I work for National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration, and our branch there in Ann Arbor is called the Great Lakes Environmental Research Lab. And actually, I was going to start off by telling you a joke that somehow came to mind during Fred's session yesterday, where a guy is in a shipwreck and falls out of his boat and grabs onto a piece of flotsam and floats around, and then finally is drifting toward this island. And after a little while, up comes this nicely constructed boat made out of native lumber from that island, and there's this beautiful woman rowing the boat toward him, and she pulls him out of the water, and they row into shore, and he gets some water, and then she starts bringing food and says, "I hope you're feeling better now." And he says, "Yeah, I'm feeling better," and puts some salve on his sunburn. And she says, "Well, come with me up to my house." And they walk inland a little bit, and here's this very nicely constructed house out of native lumber. And he takes a long sleep and wakes up, and there's this beautiful woman, more food, you know, just nice accommodations. And then she says, "Well, how would you like to play golf?" And he said, "I can play golf here?" And she said, "Sure, I've got a 9-hole course out the back." And he goes out and plays a couple of rounds. And he says, "Boy, this sure is a nice place." And then he goes back in, and the woman says, "Well, isn't there something else that you'd like?" And he said, "You mean?" And she says, yeah, I mean that." He says, "Really? You mean I can check my email here?" I don't know how that connects with what you were saying yesterday, Fred.
You get 45 minutes to do it.
Okay.
Do you mind if I
do that? Oh, yeah. Yeah, can you see this reasonably well now? Okay, some of the resources I'm recommending up front here, I neglected to put the dates. I believe the National Geographic article was September of 2004, and also interesting are the letters to the editor that followed that in the January 2005 issue. Then one that I tried, a book that I tried to recommend to bookstore here, but they didn't seem to get it in stock. It's called Uncertain Science, Uncertain World by Henry Pollack, and he expounds on how some things in science are uncertain and uses global warming as a particular example, and really how uncertainty motivates scientific progress. And I'll give a couple of quotes from that a little later on. Then the next one is also not stocked in the bookstore here. It's called Climate Affairs by Michael Glantz, G-L-A-N-T-Z. And this gives an overview of what climate is like in various countries, how it affects them, and what their risks are going into the future. Then the next item on the list is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, and they are located at ipcc.ch, which is Switzerland. And this is really a branch of the United Nations that is tasked with doing a complete assessment every 5 to 6 years of the state of climate change and what can be expected. And looking at this website, will be like sipping water from a fire hose. There's so much stuff there. They put out each 5 to 6 years, their main centerpiece output is a set of three volumes, each of 800 to 1,000 pages. And the first one is always on climate change science. They call that Working Group 1. Working Group 2 is impacts of climate change on various places and groups of people and ecosystems. And Working Group 3 is means of mitigation, ways to reduce climate change. And then I just list other websites. There are just huge numbers of other websites, and they kind of break down by what attitude they take. There are some that are associated with various government organizations that I think are fairly neutral. NASA and EPA have them. NOAA has a smaller one. Do a Google search for climate change and you'll find a whole bunch of them. Others are more partisan. There's the Sierra Club and Greenpeace have theirs. And then there's one that uses the code word Greening Earth Society, which is actually a greenhouse warming skeptic organization. Then one of them that's kind of interesting and entertaining is called ExxonSecrets.org. And that one allows you to click on a number of scientists, politicians, corporations, and have it map all the connections between those as far as funding and who's collaborated with each other and so forth.
What's that one title again?
ExxonSecrets.org.
So that's probably not sponsored by Exxon.
No, it's not sponsored by Exxon.
They wanted it, they could have picked it first.
Okay, I'm going to start out with a preliminary quiz. Watch out for this one. Which greenhouse gas absorbs more infrared radiative energy than any other in the Earth's atmosphere? Anyone want to guess?
SO2? Sodium dioxide?
No.
Carbon dioxide?
Nope, that's the answer you expect. It's water vapor.
Water.
Yeah, and I'll go on to tell you how CO2 and water vapor interact with each other. Human influence on water vapor is a little more indirect than CO2. Then part two, when was the potential effect of CO2 to warm the atmosphere discovered?
Many years ago. 60s?
Mm-hmm. 1896, Svante Arrhenius discovered how carbon dioxide absorbs infrared radiation and can warm like a laboratory piece of atmosphere is what he was using. And then using sort of the computer models, 1967 was something that was a little more realistic, Minabe and Weatherall. And then they put together a model that puts the full dynamics of the atmosphere into the model and gives more of a geographic distribution of what you'd expect CO2 to do. And of course, it's been considerably refined since 1975. Okay, now I will tend to use the terms greenhouse warming and global warming interchangeably. What is the difference between these and the greenhouse effect? I'll just give you the answer for that. There's a natural greenhouse effect. Without human activity, there already was carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. There was water vapor in the atmosphere and a few other things such as methane. But then when people add more carbon dioxide, that's an enhancement of the greenhouse effect. So I'll call that greenhouse warming or global warming. Okay, frequently asked questions. People say, it's 107 degrees in the shade today. Does this prove that global warming is real?
No.
No. So I was, one of our instructions is to use inclusive language in our presentations. And I think global is a pretty inclusive word. Now, I'll go on to the next question, and this question and that one together have a couple of aspects that are not inclusive that kind of show what's wrong with these particular questions. So this is the opposite. We had frost in August. I went to my 20-year high school reunion in Crookston, Minnesota last year, and they had frost in August.
Wow.
Every month of the year.
Yeah, and they said, does this mean that global warming is not happening?
No.
Okay, so what's not inclusive about these questions?
Localized
for one?
One-time thing.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
there's some places that will experience either of those every month of the year.
Yeah, they're localized in time and space, and when we talk about global warming, we have to take a bigger view of things. If you have cold one week and have hot the next week, and flip-flop your attitude about global warming on that basis, you're going to be flip-flopping a whole lot. Okay, and then the other one, the weather has been weird. Is it global warming? And the
yes or no.
The manager at Denny's in Wenatchee the day I headed out here said, our weather's been funky. So, is it global warming? Maybe, maybe not. So, now I'll get a little bit more into the body of the paper. This is Henry Pollack. He's the author of the book Uncertain Science, Uncertain World. And he is a professor of geology at the University of Michigan. And his political credentials come by way of his wife, who was a state senator. And she's now a leader of a non-governmental organization, the Michigan
Environmental Council.
Environmental Council. Yeah, Lana Pollack, right. Right. And I put underneath here a quote that he uses in his book. If we begin with certainties, we shall end in doubts. But if we begin with doubts and are patient in them, we shall end in certainties. Francis Bacon. So this is a little bit of a caution against jumping to conclusions, and it's going to end up demonstrating the process of taking a more generalizable concept like global warming and working toward knowledge that's more localized and more specialized. So I kind of first came up with my own outline for this talk and then realized how much it corresponds to key questions from Pollack's book. First, has Earth been warming over the past century? If so, what is causing the warming? What will be the consequences of this change? And what can be done to remediate or accommodate the change? And this is also the outline of when I was saying the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has that website, and they have the three working groups. Basically, working group one is those first two questions. Working group two is the second, is the third question, and working group three is the final question. Okay, climate always has a random nature, and here I say it acts in random ways like rolling dice. And if you ever look at a single roll of the dice, you can't tell whether they're weighted or not. So that goes along with the single 107 degree day. Yeah. So you really need to build up an ensemble. And as of yet, the dice are not weighted all that heavily, so it still takes some doing to really pick up on the global warming signal. And any observations are not labeled to distinguish global warming from natural variability. And another thing we talked about at yesterday's session was another thing that can cause changes in climate is land use. If you put in a large area of irrigation, and that can have local effects on climate. If you keep building up a city, the urban heat island, that can have an effect. And maybe you've heard about the attempts to correct climatic observations for the urban heat island effect. That's something you do in order to see whether there's greenhouse warming. Nevertheless, that urban heat island effect is a real phenomenon. It's making it warmer in those particular places. All right, climate modeling and observation. Observation gives highly reliable information about the past and the present. In a lot of cases, we'd like it to go further into the past than it does. Then on the other hand, we use climate models as a source of information for the future. They are considerably less reliable. It's our best educated guess at what's going to happen in the future. But then when you put them together, you get more of a basis for having an expectation of warming in the future and attributing what warming is already observed to human causes. One of the main means that's used for attribution to human causes is to compare the spatial pattern of observed warming up until now with the spatial pattern of predicted warming in those models. Okay, here's how to build the climate model and run it on a computer. You divide the Earth's atmosphere into the smallest pieces that your computer can handle. You divide it into blocks in longitude and latitude, and then divide it into layers vertically. Then there are equations from well-known theory, and you can get winds from that. And when I say radiation, this does not mean radioactive materials. This means light, both visible and invisible. It means sunlight coming in and infrared thermal radiation going out. And that's light that's emitted by everything according to its temperature, but generally it's in invisible wavelengths. And then you also use the equations to predict temperature changes. And then all of these things have to be on scales at least as large as your grid spacing. So you can only use the well-known equations on fairly large chunks of the atmosphere. Kind of standard now is about 2 degrees of longitude by latitude. So that's about 150 miles on a side. So you're dividing it into big chunks. Now that's for the global models of climate, and some of what I'm using is more of a regional scale thing, and that's more like 25 miles on a side. But that is a slow process to do those simulations. Okay, next is to make more of an educated guess at what's happening at smaller scales. So once you've divided the world into those large blocks, you know there are other things going on at smaller scales than that, such as thunderstorms. And even hurricanes are just barely resolved by those models. So you need to make a little more educated guess. And cloud formation is an important one that still has some question marks on it. Then you run to simulate it 200 years or so. That's what the global modelers usually do. So they'll start it. Standard is to start it at 1900, run it for the 20th century so that you have history to compare it to, and then run it out to 2100 for the future projections. And looking out into the future like that, there are various standard scenarios of how much carbon dioxide is emitted, but that's one of the main questions in what's going to happen in the future. Now, how climate prediction differs from weather prediction, or the objection people bring up, we can't get next week's weather right, how can we get it for the next century? Now, if I were to run one of these models, and today is June 15th, so if I were to try to simulate June 15th of 2055, I wouldn't expect it to actually match up with the weather patterns that will be happening on that particular day. But instead, you run it over a number of years and try to get a range of possibilities of what might happen on June days between 2050 and 2060. Okay, this is getting back to the water vapor question, and this is the source of this is from 1967. And this is sort of the original paper on global warming, excluding that Arrhenius one. And it gives some of the basic results. And one of the important results is this feedback from water vapor. So what these people did was started with a certain amount of carbon dioxide content, and about 300 parts per million, the middle row there, was approximately what the CO2 concentration was at that time. Right now it's about 380 parts per million. So they just ran this relatively simple model of climate. It was just a one-dimensional vertical column of air that they simulated, and put in the absorption due to carbon dioxide, and assumed that the Earth reflects so much solar energy. And in the column in the middle there, where it says fixed absolute humidity, they kept the amount of water vapor in the air constant among these three amounts of carbon dioxide content, and got about a 1.25 degree. This is on the Kelvin scale. Most of you probably aren't used to that. Subtract 273 to get Celsius, and those are the near surface temperatures that they got, and they're spread out by about 1.25 degrees between each of those. Then in the right hand column, it's fixed relative humidity, which means that as the temperature increases, the capacity of the air to hold water increases, and the relative humidity is the fraction of that capacity to hold water. So as the temperature increases, with fixed relative humidity, the amount of water vapor in the air increases. And that becomes a positive feedback. You get more greenhouse gases in the air in the form of water vapor. So this has a greater sensitivity. The difference between each of those CO2 concentrations is more like 2.25 degrees, whereas it was about 1.25 degrees in the other column.
Does that mean, can I ask a question?
Mm-hmm.
Does that mean the more humid it is, the more things are going to be affected? The more global warming is going to, or the higher the temperature is going to be?
That means, yeah, the more humid it is, the higher the temperature is going to be, because water vapor is a greenhouse gas.
Okay, so in 1967, of those 150, 300, and 600, maybe I missed that. So
300 is about what they had at that time.
Okay, what are we experiencing now?
Now is about 380.
And this is...
So the... I'm not a good science person. So the combination of carbon dioxide and water vapor,
mm-hmm.
is an indicator that there's... It's a more volatile combination. It's going to produce more effects.
Right. And this is really one of the spots where skeptics pick at the greenhouse warming theory. Because they a lot of them want to claim that there's going to be less of an effect on water vapor, especially higher than about 1 kilometer in the atmosphere. And that is important, whether that actually ends up happening or not.
So what does that mean for rain and how the water then is evaporated into us and into the earth?
Yeah,
that's up for.
That's one of the things that's a little bit more uncertain. Generally, it's expected that there's going to be more rain, but.
But that's kind of expected, that it'll be more rain for a period of time, and then and then at some point we'll start to see less rain and more desert-like. Or is that part of the theories?
Well,
those are just part of the theories that are out there?
Yeah, I mean, things are thrown out about more droughts and more floods, and I'm not sure I'm entirely convinced about that.
Because I know back in the mid-80s, that was the kind of the theory that was out there, you know, certainly.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to be showing you some of the studies that were particularly aimed at Great Lakes levels. And there are a bunch of studies, and they conflict with one another.
Okay.
Question?
Yeah.
Isn't part of where the skepticism comes from too, that although water is a greenhouse gas, if it causes greater cloud cover, you have greater reflectivity
and
radiation, so you get less heat. So there are people who actually said it's going to cause cooling.
Yeah, no, there's another layer to that where clouds actually act as a very strong greenhouse gas, even stronger than water vapor, and sort of which way that tilts as far as whether their reflective properties or their greenhouse properties
outweigh
each other depends upon how high those clouds are. The lower clouds have the reflectivity as the major effect, and the higher clouds have the greenhouse part of it as the major effect.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it seems to me then among those who are convinced that there's global warming issues or greenhouse issues, it's how it's going to go are the discussions. But then there are those who are absolutely convinced that this isn't even an issue, right? Or are we kind of globally now saying, yeah, this is a real issue?
Those who are scientists and are somewhat skeptical really do admit that this is a real effect.
And they
tend to pick at little pieces of it and say, well, you know, this little piece might not quite be right, and that might reduce the amount.
So it's American politicians who aren't convinced yet.
Right.
Some, right.
Yeah, and it's, you know, many members of the public as well.
Right.
Okay, so here's some observed records of climate, and I pulled this figure from the IPCC website. So these are collections of physically observed, directly observed global temperatures over the past 140 years, and it shows a rise. However, one of the things you might notice is from about 1940 to till the mid 70s, it looks like there's a little bit of a decrease. So that, you know, that kind of fools you a little bit there. Then reconstructions over the past 1,000 years show some ups and downs in the past, but relatively steady, and then in the much more recent past, a large rise. And there are some skeptics who criticize the statistical methods that were used to arrive at that curve in the lower part.
The upward curve at the end?
Basically, what they're skeptical about is what they call the hockey stick shape of this curve, and they think that they used statistical calculations that inevitably come up with a hockey stick shaped curve. So one with basically one bend, one major bend to it.
What seems to be the potential cause or causes for the lowering in the 1940 to 1970 period? Or do we know?
There may have been some effect by volcanoes, a little bit of solar output, and actually the next slide will show this shows in part A, the upper left, natural forcing only. So all three of these panels show the same curve for observations in the red. And then they've run models to try to replicate that. And in part A, it's natural forcing only, which means changes in the amount of aerosols from volcanoes, in the amount of output from the sun, and I was looking for a drop there between 1940 and 1970. I mean, it looks more like it's really concentrated in one spot within that range.
Well,
that, anyone going to say something?
How much does, you know, when there was, and that previous slide, there was a, you know, just before that drop, there was a remarkable increase
mm-hmm.
in heat.
Mm-hmm.
So how much does that, when it goes up, even like, you know, does that melt or warm up extremely cold lands or areas? And then when that starts, sees a warm up, does that cause warming up in other places?
Are you talking about feedback from melt of
places like
polar caps?
Yeah.
That's another mechanism that's expected is melt of those the ice near the poles. resulting in less reflectivity of sunlight, or yeah, less reflectivity, right? So part B is anthropogenic forcing only. That means only the addition of greenhouse gases, ignoring the effects of such things as volcanoes and solar output. And then part C is the two of them together, and it ends up tracking very well between the model and the observations in that case.
But if there were no human effect, we'd be a little cooler than we were. The Earth would be a little cooler. I mean, according to chart A, the Earth would be a little cooler than it was in 1800.
Yeah, I guess it looks that way. Okay, now, global warming results are not created equal. The top rank, most certain, is an observed increase in greenhouse gases. You can just take samples of the air and find what chemicals are in them. Next lower is observed on the one hand and expected using modeling techniques, temperature increases. Then still lower is attribution to human causes. Then more questionable are just a myriad of things, many things that make climate of concern to people. This really involves all sorts of questions that fall under the heading that I call "So What?" Okay, then this is cascading uncertainty, and this is not showing up very well on the screen. That says global climate in that box. You kind of consider that to have the highest level of certainty. Then individual climatic elements, precipitation, temperature, etc., have a little bit lower level of certainty. Then if you break it down into smaller areas, you're looking at things that have more of a signal-to-noise ratio problem and really are not quite as well understood. So I was presenting this to a group of Great Lakes people, so I broke it down by global, then North America, greater specificity, Great Lakes Basin, lake, and then an individual site. And then you look at the resultant physical characteristics. If you're looking at a lake, you might want to know what does the temperature look like with depth in that lake. So then from that, you might go to some ecosystem type of considerations. Is that going to have an effect on runoff, which will carry nutrients and contaminants into a lake? And then you might want to look at different species that live in that lake on an individual basis and effects on the entire ecosystem. And those just interact with each other quite a bit. This is switching gears a little bit, going to this study by Hansen et al., which was published about a month ago in Science. And what he did is measured overall heat energy inputs to global oceans and found that the oceans are accumulating heat to a significant extent, really confirmed that, and that shows that there's a delay, there's sort of a potential amount of heating of the Earth that's being bottled up in the oceans for now, but will be released later. So this proves that greenhouse warming will continue to happen even if greenhouse gas emissions are immediately eliminated.
So a bit like the whole zero population growth problem. Even if you reach zero population growth in a society now, the population pressure causes the population to increase for a while.
I didn't quite understand.
That's right, just make an announcement that even if you stop putting greenhouse gases in, that doesn't mean the effect ends. Mm-hmm. because you've stored up this heat reservoir in the oceans.
Right.
It's the same thing with population pressure.
Right. Okay. And I say this is a landmark study, but it says almost nothing about any but the first box on the previous diagram.
So along that whole cascade of uncertainty, you've still got, you know, this study says very little about what's going to happen in individual areas and to individual species. Someone over here had a question?
Oh yeah, I'm starting to ask something. And how does he measure, and why is it getting warmer in the oceans?
It's getting warmer in the oceans because they're absorbing sunlight and not getting rid of that heat as they normally would have. If they were in equilibrium, they'd be getting rid of the same amount of heat that they're taking in. But as of now, they're not doing that. They're just storing it up.
So now the oceans can't release it the way they used to. There's some blockage.
Right. Yeah, basically it's the greenhouse gases that are causing that blockage. The oceans would ordinarily release a lot of that heat in thermal radiation to space. So I have 17 minutes, and I have some more material to cover here. This is zeroing in on the Great Lakes, and this is yours truly who did this work here, and that's me in unison with the sled dogs. Yeah.
Did you run those?
Yeah, I just took a weekend just for fun. I wasn't competing. I don't know why people think if you run sled dogs just one time that you're in a competition.
Well, when you live up there.
Is that how you get around?
Right. Now, what these graphs are showing is observed lake temperatures and some of the predictions that I've made with them using a model. And the heavy line at the bottom is the observed lake temperature. And this is kind of showing a little bit of the problems that occurred with my model. The next line up from that in each of these graphs is what I predicted as the temperatures of Lake Superior, Lake Michigan, each of the Great Lakes. That's what I predicted as the temperature in the recent past, 1990 through 2000. And the problem is they don't match up. Those temperatures are really too high. And then the next curves up are predictions for 2030 and 2095. So those have increasing temperature, but there's still that problem with the base case, the recent time being not matching up with observations. And one of the mechanisms that we're looking at for affecting Great Lakes water supplies and lake levels is a decrease in the amount of ice going into the future. Decreased ice means more evaporation. So that would be expected to cause a decrease in lake levels. There will be other effects acting as well. But because of this bias in the current simulation of lake temperature, essentially you're starting out with no ice. So you can't reduce the ice relative to zero. Essentially, we've lost that mechanism. And this is a really poor graph, but basically on the right, it's showing that I'm predicting an increase in the amount of water input to this is specifically Lake Ontario, but it really holds for all of the Great Lakes. Going into the future, I'm expecting an increased amount of water input under this model. And this is kind of a roundup of various publications that have dealt with the amount of water going into the Great Lakes under greenhouse warming, and you can kind of count them. There are several that have decreasing amount of water, several that have increasing amount of water, and you'll see Lofgren et al. 2002 actually goes both ways. We use different global models as input there. And then you also see the name Weatherald and Wanabe. They're the same ones who published that paper in 1967. They're still around. Wanabe is officially retired twice, but he's still working. So we used a few different methodologies to address this question. They each stress different factors, but each of them really has some sort of flaw in it. And I'm putting forth the hypothesis that the true answer may be less water early, but more water later. As you actually get the condition of having no ice, as you go forward from that, you may end up with more water.
How much do people get into like different camps? Because I saw like the Crowley guy, or Crowley, mm-hmm.
yeah.
is in the first section,
mm-hmm.
and then I mean, you were in...
He works right down the hall from me.
Oh, and then the Wanabe and other guy.
Yeah, now...
Do they get like so entrenched in their camps that they can't get out of them, or...
Here's my history with these people. Wanabe was my grad school advisor. Then I went and left his office and started working for Crowley. and Chow, I just barely know, actually. And Millie et al. Was on my PhD thesis committee.
I guess what I'm asking is just like how entrenched in their positions on these, I mean, do they stay open to looking at things, or do they get so, you know, I said this once and into a certain camp?
Actually, my primary co-author on that one called Lofgren et al. 2002, I actually sometimes worried about him really being too invested in the decreasing amount of water.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so, yeah. He's retired now, too.
So you're it, huh?
Yeah. Now, this is a study by Brandt et al., and he's now my boss, Steve Brandt on the top there. I tried to get a more current picture of him. I took my camera to his office the other day, but he was gone. And this is a prediction of Chinook salmon growth in the... I believe this is in Lake Ontario, and the red shows, the vertical axis here is depth within the lake, and the horizontal is time of the season, starting from January on the left and December on the right. And the red shows the depth where temperature is optimal for growth of these Chinook salmon. So the base case is the recent past, then you've got 2030 and 2090 looking out into the future. So for some times of year, it looks like it's improved, but during midsummer, near the surface, it's not so good. And one of the weaknesses of this is it only takes into account temperature for their growth. It really doesn't take into account whether they can find something to eat.
Right.
Okay, now this is another of my colleagues on the right, Jeff Andresen. He holds the title of State Climatologist of Michigan. He works at Michigan State University. And here we're pictured in Nairobi, Kenya. And this is just a little bit of a preview for tomorrow's talk. The guy on the left is Jeff's grad student, Karsten Schein. Anyway, Jeff is a Lutheran. And for those of you who know Lars Claussen, Jeff is a member of one of Lars's former congregations. And Jeff is working on climate change effects on tart cherry production in Michigan. So
big deal in Michigan.
Yeah, in the Traverse City area especially. So one of his motivations for doing that is that the yield of tart cherries is strongly affected by climate. And he said it ranges from 0% to 150% of the normal over the last 10 years, and primarily driven by climate. And they're looking at whether farmers will change their practices due to information on projected climate. They call it the Peleus Project. I'm not quite sure of the significance of that. And he summarizes the regional climate trends, and climate has become wetter and cloudier, and decreased ice.
On the lakes.
Right, on the lakes. And this is specifically Grand Traverse Bay, which is right next to the primary tart cherry production area, and showing the number of years within each decade that bay froze, and it's dropped way off in the recent past.
Right, because when the bay when the lakes freeze over, spring comes late.
Right.
And really late, up to 6 weeks later.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it affects the growing season so much.
Six weeks.
At least up in Marquette.
So his assessment is that we're expecting an increase in temperature. Trends in precipitation are less clear. And weather extremes are really talked about a lot, but the models, I don't think, support them all that well. And especially because they're so localized and the models are very coarse-grained. So that remains unknown. And here are some of the factors he threw in. Can't read it very well, but yield is at the bottom, and it has all these other influences feeding into it. And here he's looking at simulated frost damage. And the one on the top uses one global model called the Hadley Center Climate Model Version 3, and then using a different model, he gets quite different results. At the bottom, I believe this is the Canadian Climate Center coupled global model version 2. Then I use a song quote to talk about why these changes matter. This is Nancy Griffith, Trouble in the Fields. Our children live in the city and they rest upon our shoulder. They never want the rain to fall or the weather to get colder. And you know, if you don't care if it's getting warmer, then those people who are raising our food might have problems with that. So going back to this, diagram. What I wanted to talk at this point is the number of possible impacts that this could have. This begins to be a complicated diagram, but reality has various other influences feeding into this land use change and the amount of runoff, or how the economy is changing in the area of ecosystems. There are also invasive species, and all sorts of things are going on all at once. Okay, now I'm nearing the end, quickly going over some of the paths of mitigation. I've really just put very broad categories here. Reduced fossil fuel use, it of course is obvious, and that doesn't mean just driving more fuel-efficient cars, but reducing usage of cars, reducing the number of miles that people are driving, and conserving energy in heat and industrial production, use less stuff, conserves energy in industrial production. Then sequestration of CO2 is kind of a techno fix where you burn things and produce electricity or hydrogen on site, and then you're able to capture the CO2 and bury it in the ground, hopefully very permanently. And then greenhouse gases other than CO2 I haven't really talked about too much. Water vapor is something that's indirectly controlled. You can't really use that as a path of mitigation. Another major one is methane, which is primarily produced by cattle digestive systems. So fewer cattle means less methane. Summary, beyond is it real, which is the first thing people generally ask me when I say I study global warming. They say, is it real? And the simple answer is yes. But then there are many questions that fit under so what, and it depends upon your particular angle on it. And I mentioned Gregory Bateson yesterday. His definition of the essential unit of knowledge is a difference that makes a difference. So if you have a difference in temperature and your children live in the city and never want the rain to fall or the weather to get colder, maybe it's not a difference that makes a difference, but for what makes a difference will differ among people. So you just have these many versions of so what. And basic principles of global warming have a very strong scientific consensus, but many of the so what questions have more uncertain answers. So that's the end of my presentation. We only have 2 minutes officially for questions, but I will be happy to continue on in private conversation. Yeah, Carla.
I'm curious that you're not using the term climate change instead of global warming. I know Vern Ehlers, who's a U.S. representative mm-hmm. from my neck of the woods in Michigan, is a physicist, and he likes the term climate change because he just doesn't think it's really global warming, but there's climate change.
Mm-hmm.
But I haven't heard you use that term.
Yeah, it's just what I've gotten used to using. I would say that some of the things I talked about as far as land use change effects on climate fit more under the heading of climate change rather than global warming. My talk tomorrow on East Africa is going to more specifically zero in on that, the land use change aspects of climate change.
Is there a correlation between studies that say global warming isn't as serious? Is there a correlation with who's financing the study, or are they all very objective?
There does seem to be a correlation with who's financing the study, yeah.
Like is ExxonMobil one of the big players in this?
Yeah, well, check out that ExxonSecrets.org website.
I was giving some presentations on Fair Trade Coffee and talking about how rainforests are so wonderful because they sequester some of they mitigate some of global warming, I thought. So hearing that humidity actually kind of increases global warming makes me wonder about rainforests. What are your thoughts on rainforests?
I don't know about that specifically. In that sort of region, it tends to be more the amount of energy that's available that controls the amount of evaporation. So evaporation requires an energy input, and I think in general you're going to get pretty close to the same amount of evaporation regardless of what you plant there, you know, unless it's like scattered shrubs or
okay, so the humidity
like
of rainforests you don't see as a problem in terms of producing more humidity and therefore affecting temperature?
No, I really have a hard time calling it a natural process like that a problem.
I know. That's why I was shocked about this whole humidity factor.
I think we'll have to officially close, but I'd be happy to talk to you privately. And,
thank you.
Thank you very much. Have your hand up back there.